Guys, Webb Johnson with Quaker Neck Outfitters, formerly Quaker Neck Gun Club, is on today. Awesome podcast. Webb Johnson has his hands in just about everything when it comes to waterfowl hunting on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Big time goose hunter, puddle duck hunter. This guy has his own managed impoundment system right along the Chester River. Wonderful guy. He knows everything about waterfowl hunting in Maryland here. And one cool thing is he's driven himself like a wedge into Annapolis, where they're making laws and regs for our waterfowl seasons. And he is making a difference, you know, for the guys that are out hunting all the time. He's boots on the ground every day. His company's working from September 1st until, you know, February. So this guy knows his stuff. You can learn a lot from this podcast. We go over guiding and what it is to be a guide on Maryland's Eastern Shore, the ups and downs and things, you know, failing dams on impoundments and big floods and things like that, but also a lot of legality stuff, things that, you know, a lot of people don't understand why bird numbers are set the way they are. You can learn all that and more right here. Hope you guys enjoy. Hey guys, what's up? Hey, Dependable Dog Services LLC is a duo of dog trainers who have spent years in the trade, and now they are their own company. They are helping people have better relationships with their dogs now. If your dog is an issue, it's a bit of a problem child. No matter what the issue, these folks can help you with it. You get a puppy, you want to make sure it's trained up right. These folks can help you with it. Dependable Dog Services, DependableDogServices.com. Give them a call at 240-707-0422. Thanks, guys. Guys, I want to let you guys in on a little secret on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Webb Johnson, Quaker Neck Outfitters, and Gun Club. These guys are top-notch when it comes to killing whitetails, doves, and waterfowl of any species. These guys tear up birds in flooded impoundments on creeks, ponds, rivers, you know, the bay. These guys are doing it all, and they're doing it really well. They aren't a guide who baits a hole with corn. They just flood a cornfield and hunt it. You can go down there right here in Maryland, and you can have a flooded cornfield hunt. How cool is that? There's been a lot of pintails around. How about a black duck? How about a teal? Anything you want, really, guys. Hey, the sky's the limit over there. Pit blinds, A-frames. Check them out. QuakerNeckGunClub.com. Yo, what's up, everybody? It's Mike. Hey, I want to let you guys know real quick. My wife and I own JC Estate Prep Services as well as Junk Clear. What we do is full scale, top to bottom, everything. Everything from cleanouts and deep cleaning and landscaping and renovations, repairs, mold remediation, tree work, like demo. We'll do anything in the home to get the home prepped for real estate. We also do the same stuff outside of a real estate situation if you need it. We do moving. We do storing. Estate situations. Grandma or grandpa just passed and you guys need someone to take care of all the headaches that go along with it. How about an estate sale? I got a connection. We'll help you guys through the entire thing. Storage. Everything. So rental resets, real estate preparation, and estate situations, estate sales. You need to get everything done. Look, everybody leads their own lives. How about this? How about instead of cramming all this stuff in, you let us take care of it for you. And oh yeah, we'll get paid. We accept payment on the back end at closing. We do like to get paid up front like anybody else, but we will accept payment at closing. We can put anything in a contract, guys. We do everything. We have vendor lists, subs, the whole thing. So reach out, let us know. If you guys know any realtors, hey, do your buddy Mike here a solid. Reach out. Tell him about us. Tell him about what we do. What we're doing is really cool. It's been kick ass. I'm not even going to lie. Like, the people that we work with are mind blown at how fast we can get this stuff done and how quickly they can then get the house sold and how much more money they can then make. It's pretty tits. And everybody wins. Okay. Everybody wins in the situation. You get more money. Realtor gets more money. We get paid. Everybody's happy. I get to feed my kids. You get to sell a home and make $100,000+, $300,000, whatever. You get to make all that money, okay, quickly and efficiently. Reach out to your realtor friends. Let them know about us. I appreciate you. Thanks. Hey, everybody, Mike here with Webb Johnson. Webb, can you introduce everybody or introduce yourself to everybody and tell everybody who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
I'm Webb Johnson. I'm the owner of Quaker Neck Outfitters. I'm down in Chestertown, Maryland. We specialize in puddle duck hunting, deer, dove, Canada goose. It's all day guided hunting, and I run five guides time.
And what's your background? How did you end up doing this? It's one hell of a path to get to where you're at now.
So my father and my grandfather started it all. And then my father retired and I bought him out and took over. It used to be called the Quaker Neck Gun Club. And that's why we're now Quaker Neck Outfitters. We had to make the change when, legal purposes came through. And then my father and grandfather also farmed. I farmed as well. So that's where, that's what I do full time is farm. And then come winter, September 1st, we start into dove season and roll right into deer and then go into duck and goose and finish the season out with rabbits and youth hunting in February.
So you guys are this is a multi-generational thing. You guys have been doing this for a very long time now, it seems. Is this something that's almost like you were meant to do it? If your grandfather and father did it, it's like somebody had to do it in the next generation.
Yeah, my father incorporated the business in 1981. Prior to that, they just took people out and, a business, but it was, I guess, set up differently. My grandfather, he was all around the world. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of birds he had. He actually had a logbook, of everything he killed and pictures and tallies and where and when. And it's pretty phenomenal numbers.
Yeah, that's amazing. Something I've wanted to do is get a logbook. I've been a little lackadaisical in that. Something that I've been telling myself I'm going to do for my kids. So it's pretty sweet to be able to look back on the amount of birds that he harvested in the back when they used to say that better times or the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days when Canada geese with black disguise out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Polar religion just to get one flock in a picture.
Right. Right. Yeah. So guiding on the Chesapeake Bay is a Chesapeake Bay, obviously being such a staple in the waterfowl community. I know it doesn't get its due anymore because it's not what it once was. I know a lot of people talk about the Midwest now and Kansas and those areas, Arkansas for your puddle ducks, for your mallards, and then, you know, out Wisconsin way, the Dakotas. Guys are actually pushing that way and up into Canada instead of talking about Chesapeake Bay. And so guide life now, like, what's it like guiding the Chesapeake Bay now? It's a lot harder, I'm sure.
It is. We're really not on the bay. We're more on the riverside in the Chester River here, right outside of Chestertown. You know, it's a lot harder than it used to be. The bird numbers are trending downward. You know, there was a big number everybody got thrown out this year. You know, the Canada goose was down 33%. And it seems like social media picked that up this year and actually blew it up to the people, you know, to the general public. Finally seemed to hear about it and pick it up and ran with it and cared about it a little more. Start looking at these numbers more than normal, I would say. You know, the downward trend overall is negative. It's not good. But people also got to remember the Atlantic Flyway. We're the smallest flyway out of all four of them. We're also the only flyway that's ever had to go through a moratorium for any waterfowl. You know, we were in 70-year moratorium when I was a kid, for Canada geese.
Well, it seems like it's something that, like, through guiding, you get to look at this all the time. You're constantly around the birds, and you constantly actually see numbers. I mean, I do too. I do. I'm blessed enough to hunt the Chesapeake, the upper. So I do see big pushes of birds from time to time when we get some cold weather and things. And but a lot of the guys, like, around the area I grew up hunting, which is Central Maryland, Carroll County, and Frederick County. Yeah, we're hunting quarry geese. We're hunting some residents and things like that. But, and yes, there's migratory birds here from the spillover from the bay and from the Atlantic Flyway. But, you know, I get to see it firsthand, but you especially get to see it firsthand, just how different it is than it once was. And it's a struggle every year, that's for sure, because you get told one thing one year, you get told one thing the next. Things are up and down, changing. People are freaking out. Then people are saying the numbers are great. Then bird numbers are up. So I never really know what's going on. I just kind of hold my hands in the air and go, well, I did see like 3,000 geese yesterday. Like, I don't know what else to say because I'm not a scientist. So,
yeah, I can't say I'm a scientist on it, but I'm fortunate enough to be able to get invited to WAC meetings, and, you know, Wildlife Advisory Council meetings. I get to go over with DNR. I get to hear their spiels a couple times a year and their the projected seasons and what all is going on. And I get to voice some opinion to them. We also recently been playing over with the delegates for the past 2 years. So they are calling and asking for opinions now on hunting laws and regulations that they don't understand or they don't know. Instead of just taking DNR's word for it, they're actually coming to the people that live and breathe this stuff, and they listen to us. It's kind of a pretty cool turn in that. And on the number side of the world, what I would say is, you know, the Midwest and everything, they still get their weather. This year was an exceptionally odd year for the nation, being so dry, such a big drought, so warm, even, you know, into Canada being so warm into Christmas and January there.
Yeah.
But agriculture has changed so much, and agriculture has changed the flights of the birds. You know, it used to be when I was a kid, when you were a kid, you know, all it had to do was get cold. And there was no food in Canada. They didn't grow corn. They didn't grow soybeans. The genetics weren't there yet. So all it had to do was get cold. Those birds migrated out of there. Now Canada grows corn and soybeans, in certain territories. Now that bird's not leaving until snow cover covers it up for X amount of days. But if it's only snow cover for 2 or 3 days, he's not leaving yet. He's still running on fat reserves. You know, he's banked up enough fat reserve. He might sit there for a week until there's a foot of snow on the ground and it's negative 20. And he doesn't have to migrate. So the agriculture industry is really what has changed the migratory birds and how they migrate and when they migrate nowadays compared to what it used to be.
Yeah, they're also it got so damn cold so early in central Canada that the birds were leaving. It got so cold that the crops were dying and freezing up completely solid, and the birds were leaving before Christmas. And now that does not happen. I mean, I think we talked about it on the phone a couple of weeks ago. I got a buddy up there, man, who guides, and they were beating the brakes off of birds until the end of the season, through youth seasons, extra seasons, what, you know, goose, no duck. They were just beating them up. And it was every time he went out with a guided group, they were stacking piles on truck hoods. And it was
guys that are up in Saskatchewan. Actually, they're in North Battleford, which is above Saskatchewan by, you know, an hour or so. And kind of the big ground up there that you want to be in. And he told me at Christmas, there were still thousands of ducks and geese up there. They weren't froze. They hadn't left. You know, some of them had, but they really hadn't. I think the season was closed by then up there. God knows what kind of detrimental numbers we would have seen from the Canadian hunting.
Yeah, he was posting pictures, and I mean, he's a guide all over, does many things, and I thought he is having like the best year I've ever seen him have. But there again, it was the warm weather. The birds didn't have to leave, and I don't know one way or the other. I said I'm not a scientist, but when people turn their nose down about global warming or this and that, I think I don't know any different, but I can tell you that over the years, you know, slowly but surely, we've seen birds later and later. And some years are good. Some years we get a cold snap. Last year, right before Christmas, we got that brutal ass storm come across the Northwest, and you know, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, and Texas got some of it, and birds shoved east and they shoved south. And we did get a bird. I killed the hell out of birds that week. But we're not getting when I was younger, when I goose hunted, I stopped hunting geese in fields because they didn't migrate. Like it got to the point where it was like, this is dumb. We're hunting stale birds that have been stale for 3 weeks. And that's not fun.
No, it gets old. It gets old fast. Thankfully, I got a good group of guys, and you know, they're good at entertaining clients when it's slow. And most of the guys that we take anymore are hunters and not just somebody who wants to pull the trigger and understand that when it's sunny and 70 in January in Maryland, that nothing's happening. You know, we might kill them here at the very end of the day and the very first light in the morning, but they're not really doing anything else because they don't have to. They're going to go loaf around on open water somewhere, or sit in sanctuaries, that, you know, our personal sanctuaries or anybody else's that they don't have to be pressured on. And that's where they stay until they have to move.
Yeah, definitely a consistent issue nowadays. So what all, like every species different. And what species of ducks are you guys guiding for to kind of change things up for clients?
So we generally kill mallards, black ducks, pintail and widgeon, I would say, is our 3-4 bird, depending on the year. This past season, we really struggled with pintails and did a good job with widgeon. Year prior, we started killing pintails in October and never let off. I mean, we straight smoked them all season long. And that was a big help because a lot of people out there that see pintails, and pintails can be a pain in the ass to decoy. You know, they can give you 5,000 looks and then get some really good looks at you and pull off at last minute, right before you want to call a shot, and they're just jackasses. But it was nice when somebody can kill some pintails and some widgeon, not just mallards and black duck. That seems to help morale, and it's more so a trophy bird.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of spoiled over here, because through this podcast, I've talked to many people across the United States who waterfowl hunt, and there are a lot of guys who would probably give their left testicle to shoot a black duck. But we have them
not
here.
Not this year, but the year prior, he drove from West Texas. It was a 26-hour drive. He came for 3 days to kill a black duck. That's all he wanted to kill was a black duck. They don't have them, you know?
Right, yep.
They can kill canvasbacks. They can kill pintails. They can kill their widgeon and their mallards. They can kill, depending on where they are on coastals, you know, they're killing divers here and there. But they don't have black ducks. So, you know, that's the one of the few that we have that the rest of the flocks don't, the rest of the country doesn't.
Right. Yeah. That is one of those
little bird for us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those birds at this area, New Jersey. And then
Jersey's probably black duck capital.
Yeah. Jersey and Maryland here. And, my parents have a place down Chincoteague rather, and black ducks down there, you know, down in Virginia around that area. But yeah, it's really sweet. So do you guys do, like, early season, are you guys doing any wood duck hunting or?
So we'll start out in October. We get some wood ducks. We don't kill a ton of them. We've got wood duck boxes and stuff like that, but we don't. You know, if somebody calls me and asks specifically for a wood duck hunt, I tell them I'll do my best. We probably won't kill one. We might see one that, you know, 2 minutes before shooting light in the woods. And, you know, I say see one as he flies by at 90 miles an hour and you can hear him screeching. But, you know, that was probably the one flock of wood ducks that we probably have. And then we kill him some mallards and, you know, maybe a pintail or something else. Maybe a teal still floating through first light. But that keeps them happy. We're not huge wood duck hunters.
So what is the main attraction for you? Like, is it hunting flooded fields? Is it hunting the river? I mean, what's the big one for you?
Moist soil management and the flooded corn and sorghum impoundments. We've got 35 flooded impoundments now, and probably 130 acres of moist soil management that we control, that is, we let wild smart weeds and alkali bulrushes and three square and all kinds of, you know, wild food grow in for the birds. And we'll go out there and add some species here and there, depending on if we can get them to grow on the season.
I love the idea of, it's one of my future goals. I love the idea of being able to actually farm for ducks. I think that is the coolest thing. I'm not talking about flooding. I spent 10 years in stormwater management, so I understand pipe work. I understand water, and levees and dams and things. And I really want at some point in my life to own a piece of property that I can just completely deck out and smart weed the hell out of it and everything. I mean, I love it. I love the idea of it. Wild rice, everything, you know, be able to drain it. And so I'm pretty jealous. I think that's awesome.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty funny. I'll take some people. My grandfather biked off part of the river back in the late, started it in the mid 60s. And they tried to shut him down in 1971 Wetlands Act, but he'd already had all of his permits and everything. And he was allowed to continue and finish. And they're, you know, it's like a 4 mile dike that he built out and around. We've got, you know, flood pipes. We can let water in and out if we want to. We try not to let the river in unless we have a drought year and it's not raining. And obviously I need to let water in, but, we try to keep it as fresh water as possible nowadays. And I'll take people back here, and sometimes it's amazing. That's like, you know, you go back there and you kill some pintails and they're like, well, we're not going to move to a corn pond now. And I'm like, why? why do you want to leave this? It's like, you know, this is like what people dream of. And they're like, well, we paid for a flooded corn impoundment hunt, and that's what we want to hunt in. And I'm like, well, you know, I've got four other guides within earshot of us. Do you hear any of them shoot? And he's, no. I'm like, all right, then we're killing birds. We're hunting something completely different, you know, on a sunny day scenario that I know I can go back there and pick off something here or there. And, you know, that afternoon they want to go back out and you're sitting in a corn impoundment told them phones, like, it is what it is. You know, you got to make them happy. So we'll take them out there and let them sit in the corn impoundment or sorghum impoundment or whatever. Make them happy.
Are you guys going to get into diver hunting at all?
We are. We're getting into divers this year. We're going to build a blind, and I think we're going to diver duck hunt probably 2 days a week if it works out. We'll be on an offshore blind. One of my guides has his captain's license and all that, so it's kind of his world because he has to be the one to drive them in and out and, you know, do all that with the captain's license.
I got you. Yeah, that's more my cup of tea. That's how I hunt. I know a lot of people now are into trying to hunt for diver ducks. I got some buddies who really enjoy, you know, testing out guided hunts and things to see if they can. Everybody wants to kill a canvas back, and look, I get it, but I'll shoot blues all day long. I've killed all the ducks, so it doesn't bother me. But like, I'll shoot blues all day long. I don't care now. Buffleheads, they get on my nerves a little bit, you know, but whatever. But, you know,
if the birds. The one bufflehead decoy behind the blind?
No, what do we normally do is throw like three or four way out to the right or something and just let them land out there. We're like, just stay over there. Just stay.
Yeah, old wives' tales always told me when I was growing up, you always put one bufflehead decoy out behind your blind so that they don't mess with you. If they go behind you, you don't have to look at them.
That's funny. Them and ruddy ducks, man. I'd beat my head. And mergansers. I've shot so many mergansers over the years. It's like we just watch them land the decoys anymore. I'm like, oh god.
Yeah.
Don't we make kill, me shoot you. Know,
kind of funny. We killed a goldmine in a flooded impoundment this year, and just about every year, as long as it gets cold, like last year when it got that super, you know, stupid cold there for a week, we normally kill some redheads in the ponds too. But you got to think, you know, I've got 12 wells ranging anywhere from 50 gallons a minute to like 200 plus gallons a minute well. So I keep water open. And then we have, I think it's 23 ice eaters that we run. So even when it gets nasty cold and freezes up, I've got open water.
Yeah, that is the key right there. That's how we used to kill a lot of geese and up my way is we'd keep a pond open long enough, put a submersible pump or something in there, and all the rest of the guys would be sitting at home eating donuts on the couch and we'd be shooting the hell out of birds.
Yeah. You get some good snow cover, you know. Being a farmer, we've got lots of tools to play with, plows on trucks and skid loaders and equipment. We'll go plow up a field if we get a 3, 4, 5 inch snow, 2 foot snow. It don't matter to me. And we'll open up some cover crop, some good wheat or some good rye ground that's, you know, 4 inches tall, 5 inches tall. And we'll set about 120 stuffer, goose stuffers out there and throw some mojos or lucky ducks, whatever you want to run. Throw 3 or 4 of them out there and, man, you can eat the ducks up when it gets like that. Right out in the middle of the field.
So what is your favorite of all of the geese, of the ducks, what's your favorite singular species to hunt?
I like duck. Goose hunting is fun, but it's not as challenging as the duck. I like, you know, shooting in divers are fun, getting in the ring neck. In the pond, in the flooded impoundment, they get to be extremely fun. They come through, you know, Mach 90. Sometimes you call a shot and the people can't even get up fast enough and they're gone out and they're coming back around for their second pass. They knot up and guys just flock shoot into them and drop 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 So if guys can shoot at them pretty good, it's just fun. You can hear the, you know, when they cut past the blind, you get to hear the wind blowing off their wing.
Yeah, that's really cool. You guys have the ability to keep water open. Like you said, you guys do kill some redheads in there and blackjacks late. Like, just as you said, we hunt out of a layout boat or, you know, I hunt some rivers around me and things like that for divers. There's a lake up here we hunt, whatever. But you guys have the ability in such a killer area to keep water open in an area where the birds want to be anyway. And that's big time.
It definitely makes a difference. But that being said, you know, when it's cold and running water and it's frozen, it's a lot of extra work for the guides and myself. You know, we got to go check the ice eaters every day. The wells have to get checked every single day. When you're raising the water level and it's, you know, call it 6-8 inch ice out there and you're walking across ice, you get out there to the ice eater and you got to make sure it's running, or if it's quit, why'd it quit? Did it freeze over? You know, now you're playing with electric out in the water and things start getting a little hairy. And then you got to go chop out around your drain boxes every day. And we run a lot of agri-drain systems to keep our water level management where we want them. But we got to go chop that out every day because, you know, I'm pumping, like I said earlier, you know, call it 100 gallons a minute, just say, 24/7, if need be when it's cold. And you're constantly filling that pond up. Well, that ice lapses around your drains. And if you don't go cut it out, you can drain your pond overnight. When that ice gets a hold of it, now that ice starts to rise and get thick, it'll grab your boards and pick them right up. Plus, yeah, ice tears a lot of stuff up too. So,
right,
you know, you got to go out there, and we're out there with axes and chainsaws and all kinds of stuff every day, midday. That's why some people are like, well, what are your guys going to go do? I'm like, well, at 10 o'clock, we're probably going to take a little break here. Nothing's going on. Assuming birds aren't moving too much, maybe hunt till 11, depending on how birds are flying around. And I tell them they've got 25 ice eaters that they got to go check, clean the screens out on the back of them, make sure they're running, make sure it's been adjusted correctly, that the hole's adequate size with not a lot of sloshing water to scare birds off. You know, we got 35 impoundments. They got to go check all of them, make sure all the wells are running, make sure some breaker didn't kick out overnight when it got to, you know, 15 degrees or 10 degrees. And now 4-inch well lines are froze solid and busted. And so it just makes a lot of extra work. Then they might finally get to eat lunch and they're back out there by 2 o'clock some days earlier.
Is that the worst part of guiding, is just the sheer amount of work that people don't see?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. I mean, for me, it's a lot of extra work. You know, right now we're draining ponds. Once they get dry enough, we'll go out there with the skid loader and we'll pick up all the blinds, take all the grass off of them, cut all the strings off of them, clean out all the trash, bring them in. To try to write down and remember, and, you know, hey, this blind needs a new step, or the roof on this one's rotten out, or this one's got a hole in the front panel somewhere. Then I've got to try to remember where I put that list 5 months later when we start doing stuff in October or September to remember where the repair was. But, you know, I get the blinds out, I drain them, then you got to work them up. Start planting the corner to sorghum, spray it. You know, I do as much to that as I do, if not more, to the impoundments in the hunting world that I do my production crops that I make more, you know, that we make money for the farm on. Because they're so specialized.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you guys are doing a completely different type of thing. You know, it's still agriculture, but yeah, it's completely different. And that's something I never really thought about before, is is that aspect of it. You know, it's not just plow a field, you know, plant corn, flood it. You know, it's a lot more to it than that with all the piping systems and everything else.
Yeah, you got to make sure all the drains are clear, you know, pond dams. We get a big issue with mice in the off season and in the winter, I shouldn't say, in just off season. Mice like digging holes, or rats, I should say, rats, really. They get into the pond dams and they start, you know, making dens and stuff in there. This year we had one collapse. The year prior, they tunneled completely through it. And we had hunted the pond the day before for the first time of the season. It was like the first week of January. It was one of the ponds we were waiting to fill up. So it was a fresh food, fresh pond on the one farm, you know, we hunted the day before. The next morning after the sun came up, the phone starts ringing and the guides are calling me and they're telling me, hey, this pond's empty. I'm like, what do you mean it's empty? It had 4 foot of water on it yesterday and it's 5 acres. What do you mean it's empty? So I get done with my guys for the morning and get in the side by side and haul ass over there. And you're like, what the fuck? The roads flooded out. The main roads flooded over.
Oh man, that's when things can get real hairy.
Yeah, got real hairy. You know, thank God over the 40 plus years, we've got excavators and skid loaders and pans and bulldozers and all the equipment needed. But they turned into the hurry up and scramble. You know, somebody go get dirt. I got to go get the excavator. We got to get it across the road, you know, load it up, cross the road. Just to get across 20 feet, you put the thing on, you know, trailer, and then unload it, dig the pond dam up, pack it back down, you know, tamp it in, water's still running through. So you're trying to throw mud and tamp mud. And after a while, it just, you know, it gets so pungy and muddy. The ground just pumps when you walk on it. It gets crazy. But we got it fixed. And I think we got 2 more hunts out of it in the season. Because we had to fill the whole thing back up again. And that gets pretty expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. I could see that. Being as I did water work for so long, that stuff, especially in the wintertime, that sucks. That's one of the, it's when something goes awry with water, it can get, people don't realize it can get even legally stressing. Like it, the counties, the state, people want to throw, they want to point fingers and throw fines when water work, you know, when stormwater management and water management, when it goes awry, they want to start pointing fingers. Luckily, you guys have been established for long enough. You know, that you're, I would imagine most of the people around you understand that you guys are Quaker Neck and you have the club there.
Yeah. My neighbors are good. I mean, I've got a couple new neighbors here and there, but not too many. Most of them have been here as long as I've been here or longer. We're kind of down in no man's land down here.
Well,
it was a nightmare when, It was pretty good show when you come around the corner and, you know, the road's 2 foot underwater out to the yellow line and it's just running down a distance as hard as it can be. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. That'll make you think on your toes real quick.
Yeah.
So
and then of course it affected multiple other ponds because it drained into them.
I got
now other ponds were overflowing and blinds were underwater. And yeah, it took a couple of days of getting everything cleaned up.
Well, now that you spoke on that, what's the best part of guiding? What's your favorite part about it?
You know, getting a pile picture is fun. That's great. You know, everybody got their limit. That's what you know, they paid me to do, right? But the best part to me is when I get to take somebody that's never really been out hunting and they get a good hunt, but they realize how much fun it was, or the memory of, hey, this was my first time on a guided hunt experience, and the memory that they'll always have of it you know, I don't per se, I always remember all of them, but I remember certain ones, certain youth kids that I know that are, you know, grown up now. And I'm like, hey, I remember you, you were 8 and I took you out duck hunting. I killed you your first duck.
Yeah, now, that's very fulfilling, I'd imagine.
Now, one of my guides is, he was a kid at the picking house in Rock Hall, like he was an infant. And we used to take all of our birds to his father and grandfather. And he was an infant that his mom would bring out. And now he works for me. And I get to rag him about it all the time. I remember being in the picking house and your mom swing through and she was bottle feeding you. And now you work for me. Small world.
I think the Eastern Shore is also good for that. Where like, I mean, around the entire Chesapeake Bay and like down in Virginia, the water culture and the farming culture are actually the two tightest cultures I know of. It's just funny that you're in the middle of both of them. I don't think there are cultures that are as tight as those two. When it comes to neighborly people who look out for each other, families that are in it know each other. I don't know how many picking houses there are around anymore. I think,
not many.
Yeah, I think I know of like one off 50 or something I've seen a sign for, but there just aren't many around anymore. That in itself is a dying art. And so,
Johnny Clayton
really cool.
And Alexander's are the only two that I know of.
Right.
Without getting into Delaware. I mean, the guy's not in Easton. I don't know any in Easton anymore. Kent Island doesn't have it anymore. I don't know of any in Annapolis, but you're starting to get out of my territory there pretty good. And I don't know in Cecil County who's got them. There's maybe one or two up the Middletown way that's maybe a deer processor that does it on the side, because that's what they are down here anyway.
Right. Yeah.
But the traditions, I mean, the two of the boys, one's a charter boat captain, one's a mate. Two of the other guys have been working for me. One of them's been here 25 years. You know, he worked for my father, and now he's worked for me. His best friend works for us as well. And he's retired military, and the other guy farms, and the other two boys are watermen. So we get that close-knit culture and tradition run deep in all of it.
Absolutely. I think that there's an issue around the cities of Baltimore, Annapolis, your Anne Arundel County, PG County, around DC, Montgomery County, Howard. It's people are so damn disconnected and there is no sense of community. And then
no.
Here in Gettysburg, where I'm at now, grew up in Carroll County, but where I'm at here in Gettysburg, PA, right above the line, the people up here seem to move a little slower, but it's not like there's still guys who hustle and work hard, own business. I know my wife and I own a couple of businesses and there's people that still hustle, but even to me, sometimes I'm appalled at how slow people move at times. And it's a stark difference between Central and South Carroll County, Maryland, and North Carroll County, and like into Adams County, Pennsylvania, where I live, because people just don't. It's kind of the same as down there. The reason my parents have a place in Chincoteague is because they work in DC and they want to get away from all that. You know, it's not natural to do that. You know, and I think you guys still have something great. You know, I'm jealous of it. I used to work on a farm and I really enjoyed that lifestyle, man. It was like the best things are the best food you can cook low and slow. Like that's life, man. It's like it's low and slow. And in 20 years, this will be the coolest damn thing you've ever seen. But
it's going to be 70. You tell people it's 45 minute drive, just get to Walmart.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's people don't know. Yeah, but
some
on the other,
it's absolute pain, man. But most of the time, you look back, like when I go to Annapolis to go to the house and the Senate and all that kind of stuff. And I go over there, and I'm there for a day and a half, or, you know, I'm over there just making trips and like, God damn, get me out of here. How do people, you know, concrete walls and stuff everywhere. I like being out in the open. I don't want to say I don't like people, but I like being, you know, a little on the private side. I don't need that, all that hustle and all the, you know, your neighbor lives 2 feet away from you. My closest neighbor is my parents because I chose to build next to them. But besides that, my neighbor's a mile and a half away.
I think too that people lose connection to the ground they live on. Like people that live in Arizona in Flagstaff in the city limits will move to Annapolis and settle down for a new job, and then they'll move to Miami for that same job. Like nobody gives a shit about where they're actually at. And it shows around cities and suburban areas full of trash, full of garbage. And
yep.
It's like people don't care, but you know,
nobody gives a shit and they're just chasing the almighty dollar.
Yep. I know down around the shore that there is trash here and there. You run, especially in Virginia, you really run across down there. It is pretty damn poor down there, but it's beautiful down there. And it's not a lot. It really isn't.
We're lucky where we are specifically that there's not a whole lot of trash, but I'm off the beaten path a little bit. You know, our biggest tourist attraction around here is Rock Hall. But then you get Ocean City, you know, Route 50, 301, Route 1. Then it starts getting back to, you know, something but miles of red lights and backup and accidents. And God, I couldn't imagine. You hear about it on the radio, 15 mile back to get across the Bay Bridge every Sunday. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, you gotta be like my parents in Chincoteague and leave it like 3 a.m. or leave at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night after you've been there for a couple of days because they just don't want to deal with it anymore. You know?
Yeah, I'm like, God, you know, go somewhere else.
I don't
leave me alone. Go somewhere else.
I don't know how you feel about it, but I grew up going to Chincoteague, and I remember Chincoteague when it was a whole lot smaller than it even is now, and the surrounding areas, but. We grew up down, you know, being down there all the time, all summer. We were flounder fishing. We still do. We shark fish a lot. And that's what I love. I love the fact that there's this, like, it's a touristy spot with some cool things to do, but it's still off the beaten path. And there aren't a whole bunch. There are now. It's starting to get a little iffy, but, not in terms of the people, but the amount of people, not the type of people, but still it's like, it's getting a little pricier and stuff, but it's still off the beaten path. It's still a real cool spot. But Ocean City,
ponies and all that down there.
Yeah. Ocean City, I never understood the draw. Like we would go there for one day and like a 4 day vacation in Chincoteague and we still do it and we'll drive up there and I got to wait 30 minutes to walk in a restaurant to get breakfast. And it's like, why the hell? Why they're eggs? Why are we doing this? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get it. But
I have spent a lot of time in Ocean City when I was a kid. My grandparents had a place down there, and Christ, Ocean City has changed major league. You know, when I was a kid, you know, it was, hey, I'm going out to the beach, or I'm gonna go ride my bike on the boardwalk or whatever. Nobody cared. And now I haven't been to Ocean City in 15 years, probably.
Now they'll take your bike.
Not that bad, but yeah, now they take your bike and you don't let your kids out of sight and everything else.
That's exactly right, man. I travel other places a whole lot more than I'll go to Ocean City. That is for sure. So we touched earlier a little bit. I want to kind of end the podcast with this sentiment. So we touched earlier on the fact that the bird numbers are real wonky and that we aren't getting the colder winters, which are leading, legislation. God damn, I can't get that out. And, and also Atlantic Flyway. We're seeing laws put in place and limits put in place and regs, that really affect hunters here. But really it's more that we're just getting warmer winters and the AP populations aren't, you know, these populations aren't as low as the officials, quote unquote, are saying. So, I mean, what's the future look like right now, in your opinion, for the entire Chesapeake region, for the Eastern Shore? What's it feel like it's turning into for you?
So it's going to be 30-2 this year, coming off of a 45-2 season. Prior to that, it's been 30-1 for 4 or 6 years. I can't remember now. I don't think the numbers were here like they say. I didn't travel the whole East Coast or anything like that, but they did the midwinter survey in, I don't know, call it January, you know, 4th to the 11th. So it was still really, really warm. We hadn't had the cold push yet. And, the numbers said there was 350,000 Canada geese in Maryland. I certainly didn't see it. And a lot of guys I talked to up and down the area, you know, they felt the same way. I have a hard time believing numbers. I think that I think they need to learn a better algorithm than what they use. Their quota error, whatever you want to call it, statistical error, that's what I'm looking for, keeps getting larger and larger when they give us these numbers nowadays. And it's like, well, how can you have a 30% statistical error? You know, you want to say that there's 180,000 breeding pairs, but you have a 30% statistical error. Well, that puts us down to 120,000 or less, you know, give or take.
Is this something that you think can be fixed? Can they constrict the way they're doing these surveys? Is that the best way to kind of meet it in the middle, at least? Or,
well, their surveys, I think their surveys are on. You know, they fly the same route they've flown for the past 30, 40, whatever years they've been doing it. They do that just so that way it's the same route, the same week, the same time, you know, so that way that's the standard. The thing I'd like to see, and I might get some backlash for this, but I'd like to see them set regulations and stick to them for more than a year or two at a time. You know, they set waterfowl regulations 2 years at a crack. They didn't change anything for the duck world this year for us, so it stayed the same as last year, minus a couple species that they can change yearly, depending on how their population numbers are. But what I'd like to see is, let's look at the long term. You know, just say in Kent County, Maryland, everybody called it the goose capital of the world for the longest time. Kent County, Maryland still ranks the third highest harvest county for Canada geese in the country. There's six of the top 25 counties in the country are on Maryland's Eastern Shore for Canada geese harvest.
And that's with that's
with 30-1.
Yeah, 30-1.
That's a 45-2 for 1 year. That'll be coming into a 30. And, you know, they're talking out of 10 years. So the feds set the regs. The feds set the regs everywhere. They tell you that you can be, you know, a 60-day goose or 60-day duck season, and you're allowed 6 ducks, 4 mallards, you know, 2 black ducks, yada, yada, yada. And then the state's allowed to come inside and say, well, all right, you know, here's what the Fed said. Their proposal, you know, the Fed set the regulations. Here's our proposal. Well, instead of doing to the max every year, why can't we be a little more proactive? We know the numbers are in decline. You know, why can't we do a 45-1 goose season? Obviously that's outside of federal parameters, but why couldn't you figure out a way to say, all right, well, we're going to stay at 30-2 as long as we don't lose our breeding pairs, below whatever you know, the limits are to start restricting seasons more. Even if the Feds say you can go to 45-2 next year again, why don't we just stay at 30-2 and see what it does for 5 years? Maybe the numbers will go up. Maybe we won't kill them all, you know. It's almost like kill them today and we'll worry about next year and tomorrow when that time comes. I'd like to see it set up a little better than that and set up a generation for my kids and your kids and maybe my grandkids to be able to do the sport.
Yeah, I consistently think about that.
I'd love to see that. Not just hear about the good old days, and we could talk about living through some of the end of the good old days and how we just finished killing them off because they didn't get regulated properly. And, you know, I kind of think social media has a little bit to do with that too, where people just have to have a pile picture all the time. And it's not about that. It's about a good time, about being outdoors and being in love nature and learning. And, you know, Christ, we do this every day and I still learn something new. Where I teach somebody something in the blind. I don't necessarily have to put up a picture of a limit every day. As long as somebody was happy, that's all that matters.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of the rule we live with around here is with Mountain and Marsh and in my friends group. It's we do go out, and I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I get after it. If I can get after it, I get after it. But that's because I hunt in an area that I might get after it and kill two mallards. So, like, right. You know what I mean? It isn't like I'm going out there and beating the brakes off birds where I live at. If I go to the bay, that's a different thing. We do with divers, we do very well with our setups. But when it comes to polar ducks, which I do enjoy hunting, and when it comes to geese around here, man, we just go out there and have a good time. And I still hunt hard enough to make sure that I'm putting myself in a position to kill. I'm not setting up in the wrong winds. I'm not setting decoys in the wrong direction, you know, because I know those things. Those things go hand in hand with everything else I do, but I just enjoy being out there, man. There's plenty of mornings that I take somebody out who hasn't hunted waterfowl before, and I'm like, watch, these wood ducks are going to do this. They're going to pitch over here. All right, they're going to swim right to the decoys. Watch this. And they do it. Yep. And they're like, that's wild, man. Like, how'd you know? And I'm like, that just been hunting here a while. You know, I just understand these birds. I don't know. It's just different. But
I mean, nobody wants to kill them more than me, you know. When it's a slow day and we're killing birds, and, you know, I love nothing more than getting your limit and getting you guys up the road. and you made a memory and you enjoyed your hunt. You got your money's worth out of it, right? I love nothing more than making everybody happy. But when I get to, you know, I've had bang up hunts where I've been in and out of the blind in 25 minutes, 4-man limit, you know, of maxed out limits. And great hunt, you know. I remember it. I don't remember who the clients were. I remember what pond I was in and what the weather scenarios were and all that kind of goofy stuff. I could probably go back into all my paperwork and figure it all out. I remember that hunt. It was cool. It was awesome, you know, smoked them. But like you said, I like it when it's a little slow, when you're getting pairs and singles, maybe a group of five come through and everybody gets a chance to go shoot and everybody's getting the hunt and you get that guy that's not experienced and he's like, man, I shoot targets all the time. What am I doing wrong? I can't hit the birds. I can't hit the birds. And I'm like, you know, you got to lead them a little more, or they're leading the bird when he's back flapping. Because they don't understand. You tell them, you know, it's not a sporting clay. You don't have to lead him out there. He's at 20 yards. Put the bead on his head when he's backpedaling and pull the trigger. Don't think about it. You know, get your head out of it. Just pick the gun up, point it, and shoot. If you're looking down the barrel and you see your bead, you're going to miss. You're not focusing on the bird. You know, you're looking at the bead, not the bird.
I'll tell you what, you want to tell your clients something that will make them better shots, at least for the year. This year we had a bang up early third split diver hunt. Havre de Grace, we got We got filled up with cans and blues and even reds pretty early this year, and we had some real good hunts, but a lot of shooting, and we were, and I was getting dialed in. Like, I mean, I'm a pretty good shot, but with divers, man, there's some times where it's a split second if you do get in your own head that you're going to miss, and like, you almost know it. And then, man, we went out on a couple paw duck hunts, and I would just pick the gun up, and I would shoot the mallards and be like, this is stupid. Like, this, yeah. It was almost like, not too easy, but it was like, I cannot believe how easy this was. Like, if you get good at shooting something at a bus length or at 10 feet or 8 feet, you know, flying past you, you get real good at shooting a mallard.
Yeah. And you get real good at shooting a goose.
Oh yeah. Well, that's not even, then it's not even fun anymore. You just pick them out and shoot them, you know, whatever. But anyway, it's still fun. I still love eating them, but, anyway, man, hey, it was great talking to you on the podcast, and I'm glad we got to talk about the bird number thing and something that you're so passionate about, is, you know, not fighting, but working with, the guys who make the rules and regs and kind of
fight with them.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I argue with them. Believe me. I tell them what I think, you know, well, I hold back that, you know, if it's something that's important to people, and important to the game and stuff, you know, they tell you, we got boots on the ground. We send people to Canada. We know what's going on. Blah, blah, blah. Well, I got boots on the ground too. And, you know, I'm 36. I grew up in there. I'm in it every single day. You know, get your biologist out here every single day and let him come with me. Let him see it firsthand. You know, I'll tell him how it is. It don't matter. If I think it's important, I think they should hear it. You know, I might be wrong, but hey, you're here for my opinion, so I'm going to tell it to you. I'm not going to hold back and tell you, oh, no, I think you're right. No, I think that, you know, they're doing it because of this, or they're doing this because of that. You know, I'm out here watching these things day in and day out. I go to bed with them and I wake up with them. And we're before them.
Yeah, there's no better source than the guy who's there.
I sit outside and just listen to them.
Right. Yeah, there's no better source for them than somebody like you who's in it and is every single day. I mean, those guys aren't. They might be sending those guys to Canada and they got a girlfriend and they got a wife back home and a girlfriend in Canada. They probably don't spend any time actually looking at the birds. It's probably all a bunch of BS. Just tax dollars, you know.
That's what I mean, you know. It's, you know. You get a bunch of people that live and breathe this stuff, and they tell you, we don't want this, or this isn't right for the population, or, you know, we need to do something. Well, listen to us. Take something in consideration of what we're trying to tell you, you know. I'd like to be able to, like I said earlier, pass this on, let my kids do it, or whatever. I don't, you know, want to run out in 5 years and say, well, it was a great run. Now we're in moratorium for everything because we didn't manage it correctly.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I appreciate you taking the time and explaining everything to everybody on the podcast here. And I believe everybody will come out of this a little smarter, especially locally here. But I think anywhere. I mean, a lot of people don't understand even how the regulations are put together. And
no,
so
and I tell you, there's a lot of moving parts behind that stuff. I mean, we could talk for hours of getting into that world, but I appreciate being on here. And if, you know, if there's any questions or anything that get generated that, you know, you want me to answer or whatever, I'm more than welcome to answer some questions if people shoot you questions or whatnot. I don't know how all that works.
Okay. I'll open something up for, on Instagram or Facebook or both.
If you want to reach out to me directly on it, you know.
Yep. Exactly. Tell everybody where they can find you.
Quakerneck Outfitters is on Facebook and Instagram. Or you can go to our website at QuakerneckGunClub.com. My email and my number is on there as well. You know, someone wants to call and ask a question, then I'll answer it to the best of my abilities, and if I can't, I don't know it, I'll flat out tell you, I don't know it, but I'll find the answer for you, and I'll get back to you.
All right, man. Well, hey, I appreciate you being on. Hope everybody enjoyed this episode. We'll see you guys later.
Appreciate it.